about frustration and anger, I speak with authority. But thank you very much to everybody who came and helped out yesterday. This morning is the first Sunday morning of the month, and so as such, we'll be dealing with our annual theme, which is taken this year from the book of James, the third chapter, verses 13 through 18. So let's go ahead and read that again. Madison read from the King James translation earlier. Thank you. That I will be reading from an intelligible one. I'm kidding. We have a lot of fun, Madison and I do, about that. Who is wise and understanding among you? By his good conduct, let him show his works in meekness, which is wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then gentle or peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. And so this morning, the morning of the first Sunday in May the 7th, we are looking at wisdom from above. That's the lesson we're going to be looking at. And so as we embark on our study of wisdom from above this morning, we must perforce contrast it with the wisdom that is from below to gain a better understanding of it. And so we're going to be dealing with wisdom from below and wisdom from above, much as we have before when we talk about wisdom from below, to put this contrast in place. So let's go ahead and get into that. And so we have to talk, first of all, to establish the differences between the two and why one is clearly superior to the other. We have to talk about human wisdom. That's when I say wisdom from below. When Scripture means wisdom from below, it's wisdom that is purely human, wisdom that is defined only on human terms. And before we launch into this, let's take a few moments, first of all, to talk about wisdom itself. Now, wisdom is something that has been acknowledged as a virtue universally across every culture of human history. Every culture in human history praises wisdom, glorifies wisdom, honors wisdom, says seek wisdom, says pursue wisdom, says look for wisdom. That every culture throughout the entire span of human history has encouraged its youth to be wise. And in the days of our hunter-gatherer ancestors, before we developed writing and reading and alphabets or phonetic scripts or logographic scripts, before we actually started to write things down, our ancestors would gather around the campfire at night, and the tribal elders or the tribal shaman would tell stories, and they were legends, they were myths that were intended to impart wisdom. That all the myths of the ancient cultures of the world were attempts by those cultures to talk about morality, to talk about righteousness, to talk about wickedness, to talk about wisdom, to talk about foolishness. Then all of those stories of Greek mythology that you learned in school or didn't learn in school or whatever were intended to serve that purpose. The trials of Hercules, the Odysseus' journey home, all of those things were intended to teach some sort of lesson that was of moral value. And the Greeks in particular sought wisdom. To the Greek people of the ancient world, wisdom was their chief cultural value. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 22, the Apostle Paul says that Greeks valued wisdom above all else when they were examining a belief system. They examined its teachings, they examined its own morality internally, and they compared that with what they thought was wise, or with what they thought was foolish. And so that was the criteria that they used to examine these things. And their definition of wisdom was their definition of wisdom. We'll get to that in just a minute, which was why the Athenian philosophers on the Areopagus called the gospel foolishness, because they could not comprehend a God that could come down to earth. Now, for the Greeks, that was no strange thing, because the Greeks believed their gods came down to the earth all the time. The thing that they deemed foolish was that this God who came down to earth would then give himself up as a sacrifice for everyone else. To die, to be willing to die for everyone else. That was what they deemed was foolish. So human wisdom has a long history. And it's a history that in most cultures is held up in honor. But there are some problems with that that we need to talk about. When we get into this human wisdom, it's also important to note that our word philosophy originally comes from a hybrid of a compound words. It's a compound word, and the two parts of this word are is a word for love and the word for wisdom. Sophia is the word for wisdom. The first part, philo, the love of wisdom. So that's the etymology of the word philosophy. And if you're to walk into any college philosophy class today, some of it may seem wise, and some of it may seem completely insane. And if you haven't been in one, well, ask Adam, or Aaron, or Tia, or Paige. See, the thing about human wisdom is that it's human. And when we talk about human wisdom, that throughout history, what is defined as wisdom in human circles is often subject to the person or the people who control that society. So when the Greeks talk about what they define as wisdom, that definition of wisdom is subject to those in authority in Greek society. The Roman view of wisdom was different from the Greek view of wisdom, and the Roman view of wisdom was designed by the priests and the rulers of the Romans. The Persian view of wisdom was different from the Greeks and the Romans, and their view of wisdom was defined by the Zoroastrian priests and the emperors, the Shahs. That whenever we talk about wisdom, whenever any society begins to discuss wisdom, the first thing we need to understand is that that very definition of wisdom that they have is a product of their society. And it's a product of the desires and the base appetites that that society has. And so they create this definition of wisdom that then is used to justify those very appetites. And so the things that the Assyrians deemed wise were bloodshed, wrath, and the violent domination of other people. That was considered wise to them, because that's what they wanted to do, and so they defined it as wise, so they had a justification for doing it. Postmodernism is not new. It's one of the oldest things. It's one of the oldest philosophies in existence. We just have this snazzy word for it today. Human wisdom, whenever human beings sit down to search, to seek out wisdom, to define wisdom, to look for it, to try and codify it, what is wise, what is foolish, whenever human beings attempt to do this on their own, the inevitable result of the entire search of everything that everyone does along these lines quickly becomes whatever will benefit me. That's what's wise. I could bring examples from popular culture today, but I won't. If you were aware of anything at all that happened last year, examples should scream out at you. Or this year. Or any year. Don't get me started. This is not wisdom, this is selfishness. Which is why James calls it earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. Because it's actually the opposite of true wisdom. When I think about a human search for wisdom, an under-the-sun search for wisdom, What it sort of evokes in me is our search for fairness, our search for justice defined according to our terms, our search for fairness. Now, have you guys ever noticed that when two people are making a deal together, and one person's trying to get a fair deal, right? If an outsider is observing it, the deal isn't fair. Because a fair deal is whatever gives an unfair advantage to me. That's why there's no such thing as a fair fight. Someone's always got some kind of advantage over somebody else. Now, to me, a fair fight is where all the advantages are racked in my favor. I'm fighting an old guy who can barely stand up. That's a fair fight to me. But wisdom, defined purely on human terms, is whatever I can get away with. And if you examine how various societies in human history have defined wisdom, sure, there will be some common threads. And the more self-sacrificing of the philosophical teachers might have more common threads than others. And those common threads may reflect Scripture. But on the whole, a human definition of wisdom varies from culture to culture. And what we find is that it depends greatly on those in power. And a great example for this, to look at how human beings define wisdom and fairness and right and wrong and justice and equality and all of these various parts of what we might call philosophy, is George Orwell's book Animal Farm, which I had to read in high school. And if you didn't read it, I suggest it. It's a very good book. It's written primarily as a lambasting of the communist revolution in Russia, the relationship between Trotsky and Stalin, and I won't get into that. But basically, it's about animals on a farm. The pigs take over the farm, kick the humans out, don't let the humans run the farm anymore, and the pigs run the farm, and they promise wisdom, because the pigs are obviously the smartest of all animals. And they promise wisdom, they promise justice, they promise equality for all animals on this farm that is now ours. We don't have to worry about the humans ordering us around anymore. I mean, it's intended primarily as a lambasting of the communist policies of Soviet Russia, but you could extend that out to people trying to kick out God and define things on their own terms. And throughout the course of this book, the pigs take more and more for themselves. They leave less and less for the rest of the animals. And the slogan that they have is, all animals are created equal. But the very last lines of this book are, all animals are created equal, but some are more equal than others. Doesn't that define human wisdom? Whenever humans attempt to, on their own, without any divine foundation whatsoever, discuss these lofty subjects, all of their own conclusions and constructions come crashing down around them. In the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verses 12 and 13, Solomon writes, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And the opening to his conclusion, his introduction to the book, is that it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun. And behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. This phrase, under the sun, Solomon uses it in Ecclesiastes to talk about an existence that only takes into account the human experience on this earth. So whenever you find this phrase, under the sun, it's the postmodernist atheistic view, which we noted earlier is actually really old. There's nothing new about it. All of life that has no theological framework is hopeless, useless, and meaningless. And that, understanding that, is where we start to learn true wisdom. That's our foundation. Because if this is all we have, if this world is all that there is, if when I die, that's it, then I have lived a meaningless life. Because, and sure, the atheists, those who reject God, the atheists, all of them. They say, well, there's the people after you. Yeah, but they don't matter because I don't matter. So none of us matter. So it doesn't matter what I do. Because if my life is meaningless and the only thing that has any meaning is the impact I have on others, well, they're not any more important than I am, which means that my impact doesn't even really matter because there's nothing. All human wisdom ultimately comes and devolves into an under-the-sun search. Especially wisdom that is atheistic in nature. It is the most fruitless, meaningless waste of time you could imagine. And since it happens with an under-the-sun mentality, you get under-the-sun results. All is vanity and striving after the wind. When I think about wisdom and human attempts to define wisdom, and when grappling with the complex questions in life, the deep philosophical issues, that's that word philosophy, love of wisdom, the deep issues that happen, that philosophy is there to address. Existence. Why are we here? How did we get here? Those are important questions, right? Why are we? How did we get here in the first place? And don't talk to me about the biological processes. I'm a father, I know. But how did we get here? Why does this planet sustain life? When we have found all evidence that we have gathered, all the places we're able to observe, there are places that might sustain life, but no other place does, for a fact. Why? People talk about human rights a lot these days, don't they? Why are human rights important? First of all, what are human rights? That's the first question. What are human rights? Why are they important? Why should we pursue them? Why should we advance them? Why should we defend them? Why are they a valuable thing for a society to have? Why? Morality. What is right? What is wrong? How do you determine right and wrong? And we addressed some of this in an earlier sermon that I did on postmodernism, so I'm not going to rehash all that. But simply to say, if you didn't catch it, go back and listen to it because it's a valuable listen, not because I did it, but because the subject matter is important. Any nature of important philosophical questions, all of these, you could go down the list. Why are we here? How did we get here? Human rights, morality, law, what laws should we have? Why should we have them? Every single last one of these questions has no intellectually satisfying explanation without some sort of theological framework. What I mean by intellectually satisfying is that there's no cause for it. When you attempt to define and or to explain or to justify all of these things from an atheistic perspective, you get circular reasoning. That's what you ultimately end up. You end up with circular reasoning, and you end up with kettle logic. Those are the only two options available to you. Google kettle logic sometime. I don't have the time to explain it right now, but it's a worthwhile thing to research. Those are the only two things that result. Circular reasoning and kettle logic, and neither of those makes sense. They're logically contradictory. And when we talk about philosophy and debate, what we say is those are invalid arguments. So the entire atheistic approach to philosophy and life is invalid. By an argumentative standpoint, it's invalid by their own measure of what's valid and what's not valid. The house of cards comes crashing down. And the fact of the matter is about life in general here is that without some kind of afterlife and without judgment, life here on earth has no consequences and we can do whatever we feel like. Because if when I die, that's it. There are no consequences for my actions. The only consequences that I face for bad behavior here on this earth, if there is no judgment, is the things that I suffer here on earth. And so there's no reason for me not to pursue everything I want, no matter the cost to anybody else, because if I can do it successfully enough, I will not suffer any consequences here on this earth. Because if I am good enough at what I want to do and obtaining what I want to get, even if I have to break the rules to do that, then I will suffer no consequences on this earth. And sometimes that's just how life is. If you don't believe me, ask a politician. If this life is all there is, then there are no consequences. And if there are no consequences, then there is morality. There's no morality. Because morality is based, the whole concept of right and wrong is based on judgment. It's based on consequences. Anyone who is a parent understands this dilemma here. We have to have theological framework. There has to be some sort of understanding for the divine for these to have intellectually satisfying reasons. Now, once we have established the need to believe in the divine, then we begin to go around and we begin to evaluate religions, and we can come to the conclusion and we can show people why that no other religion in the world can hold up to historical analysis like Christianity. And here's where I'd launch into a five-hour dissertation on apologetics, but I won't do that. Before I came here, it's come to my understanding, it came to my understanding, actually, before I got hired, the elders sat down with myself and had a talk about this, and they said, we had Wayne Jackson over here for a meeting once, and I'm like, okay. That was my response, okay. And he writes for Apologetics Press, he does a lot of really great work. And if you don't know why some people might think that was a big deal, then God bless you, I love you. But no, and if you weren't here for that, I suggest you go back and listen to it. Now, maybe there's one other religion that could stand up to historical analysis like Christianity, and that's Judaism. But the way Christianity holds up to historical analysis says that Judaism was valid, but is no longer valid. Was valid at one time, no longer valid. So even it can't stand up as well as Christianity can. Once we begin to understand this and do the research, apologetics, we look at this research, we begin to understand, we should, I think it's a beneficial thing to have an understanding of this. Of evidences of why the Bible can be trusted, why these people that it talks about, we can verify that they were real, that they were the places they were at, they did the things that they were did. It's valuable for us to do that because we can use this in conversations with people. And once we begin to establish this, we begin to understand we're able to communicate something that David communicated in the Psalms. And that Psalm 19 is actually a wonderful guide for us in life. Turn, if you would, to that book, this chapter, Psalm 19. We're going to look at what David had to say there. When most of us think of the 19th Psalm, we think of the song that we sing that's based on that. Psalm number 439 in our songbooks, the law of the Lord is good, right? The law of the Lord is perfect. The precepts of the Lord are right. The commandment of the Lord is good. The judgments of the Lord are clean. But that's not how David starts off a song. Verse 1 says this: the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. From day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice cannot be heard. Their voice goes throughout all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit is to the end of them, and there is nothing that is hidden from its heat. David begins the 19th Psalm by examining creation. Look at the wonderful world that God has given us. And the claim that the God of the Bible makes is that he is perfect. That he is holy, that he is awesome, that he is glorious. And David's criteria for evaluating God's own claims was to look at the creation that God has given us. Do you guys want to know something about scientists and what scientists were called 400, 500 years ago? They were called natural philosophers. Natural philosophers, the philosophy of nature, the wisdom of creation. David was a natural philosopher and a stereotypical philosopher. How do you know if a sculptor is good? How do you know? Well, you look at what he makes, right? How can we evaluate that Leonardo da Vinci was a good painter? Because the Mona Lisa will take your breath away. His understanding of human anatomy at the time was without peer. His medical drawings and sketches are still regularly referenced. You examine an artist or a craftsman by examining his work. If the God of the Bible, the God of the New Testament and the Old Testament, if he makes certain claims about himself, we should be able to evaluate those claims to determine whether those claims are valid or invalid, whether those claims can be believed or not be believed, whether those claims are true or false. And the God of the Bible claims that he is perfect, he claims that he is awesome, he claims that he is magnificent and holy and glorious. And so through natural philosophy, the wisdom of nature, we come to see that his work is all of these things. So that he is all of these things. An understanding that God's creation is awesome and magnificent and glorious then becomes the foundation that we have for saying that the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The rules of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. More to be desired are they than gold, even much fine gold. Sweeter also than honey and the drippings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them your servant is warned, and in keeping them there is great reward. And that's usually where we stop, but it goes on. David examines God's creation, and the fact that the laws of nature are perfect and good and awesome becomes the foundation for God's moral law being good and perfect and awesome and holy, thus leads him to the conclusion that God himself is perfect and awesome and holy. And that is where he ends the 19th Psalm by saying, who can discern his errors? So declare me, Lord, innocent from hidden faults. Judge me, that I may be found righteous. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless and innocent of great transgression. Let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Solomon spent his entire life searching for wisdom. Maybe he just should have read the words of his father. Might have been a bit of a shortcut. But where else do you think Solomon learned that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom? Proverbs is full of Solomon saying, incline your ear to me, my son. Listen to me. Let me teach you the words that my father taught me. True wisdom sees things as they really are. Through the natural philosophy, we learn that God's creation is good, which can help us understand that God's law is good, that God himself is good. This is the beginning of the wisdom that comes from above. So now let's get to the second half of my sermon. That is what is truly wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The laws that come down from above are the beginning of our instruction. We should look to the steward in Luke chapter 16. Let's turn there very briefly. Luke, the 16th chapter, verses 1 through 9. He said to his disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager. Charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'Well, what shall I do, since my master is not taking the management away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am too ashamed to beg. So I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 'Well, 100 measures of oil.' So he said to him, 'Well, take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. And then he said to another, 'How much do you owe?' He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. The master then commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. So I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings.'" People in this world use the things of this world to advance themselves in this world. Jesus points that out as if he tells a story about corruption. And he says, "You guys think this is smart. And under the sun, it is smart. But above, it's not. You look at the advantage these things can give you here in this life, and you understand them easily, and you can use the things that you have to manipulate others, thus securing your future. Well, what about your eternal future? You look at securing your immediate, near-term future as wise. How much more should you look at securing your eternal future as wise? So these things that you have in life, take them and use them to secure yourself a future. So that the friends that you make with this wealth will receive you into the eternal dwellings." By the way, who's the only one that has an eternal dwelling? God. We love to sing songs about, "I've got a mansion, robe, and a crown." I love that song. It's fantastic. "I've got a mansion over the hilltop." Kind of a mistranslation, but that's okay. "In my Father's house there are many rooms." That's what Jesus actually says. It's God's house. I just got a place to stay in it, which is cool enough by me. No rent. I'm down with that. The only one who has an eternal dwelling is God himself. So the friend that I must make is obviously God himself. To be a friend of God, I have to be his son. That I have to be deemed wise in his sight, which means my life is devoted to his principles. That my character becomes his character, which is last year's annual theme. That all the pursuits I have now are aimed toward them. True wisdom that is from above seeks the things above. "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all of these things will be added to you." Just as wisdom from below seeks the things from below. The most important part of wisdom, brothers and sisters, is understanding that this life is temporary. bright, sunshiny moment of the morning, one day you will die. But for God's people, that's good news. I'm going to die, and that's a great message. Because when I die as a son of God, I'm going home to glory. Because my life has been lived by the wisdom that is from above while I am down here below. I live my life by his laws because they are good and pure and perfect and clean. Because he is good and pure and perfect and clean. If you're here tonight and you would like to join us, to become a son of God, all you got to do is be born into his family. As Jesus says, you must be born again to enter the kingdom of God. John chapter 3, verse 3. In verse 5, he says you must